that felt soft. Richard identified both as obsidian. "These are volcanic rock," he said in his best encyclopedic voice. "But this isn't." He kicked a washed-out stone and waved at the formation. "This is sediment." Richard had a talent for scientific trivia. Usually, I ignored his lecturing, but today I was gripped by it, and by this strange, thirsty terrain. We hiked around the formation for an hour, returning to Grandma with our shirt fronts sagging with stones. Grandma was pleased. She could sell them. She put them in the trunk, and as we made our way back to the trailer, she told us the legend of the Apache Tears. According to Grandma, 100 years ago, a tribe of Apaches had fought the U.S. cavalry on those faded rocks. The tribe was outnumbered, the battle lost, the war over. All that was left to do was wait to die. Soon after the battle began, the warriors became trapped on a ledge. Unwilling to suffer a humiliating defeat, cut down one by one as they tried to break through the cavalry, they mounted their horses and charged off the face of the mountain. When the Apache women found their broken bodies on the rocks below, they cried huge, desperate tears, which turned to stone when they touched the earth. Grandma never told us what happened to the women. The Apaches were at war, but had no warriors, so perhaps she thought the ending too bleak to say aloud. The word slaughter came to mind, because slaughter is the word for it, for a battle when one side mounts no defense. It's the word we used on the farm. We slaughtered chickens, we didn't fight them. A slaughter was the likely outcome of the warriors' bravery. They died as heroes, their wives as slaves. As we drove to the trailer, the sun dipping in the sky, its last rays reaching across the highway, I thought about the Apache women. Like the sandstone altar on which they had died, the shape of their lives had been determined years before, before the horses began their gallop, their sorrel bodies arching for that final collision. Long before the warriors' leap, it was decided how the women would live and how they would die. By the warriors, by the women themselves. Decided. Choices, numberless as grains of sand, had layered and compressed, coalescing into sediment, then into rock, until all was set in stone. I had never before left the mountain, and I ached for it, for the sight of the princess etched in pine across the massif. I found myself glancing at the vacant Arizona sky, hoping to see her black form swelling out of the earth, laying claim to her half of the heavens. But she was not there. More than the sight of her, I missed her caresses, the wind she sent through canyons and ravines to sweep through my hair every morning. In Arizona, there was no wind. There was just one heat-stricken hour after another. I spent my days wandering from one side of the trailer to the other, then out the back door, across the patio, over to the hammock, then around to the front porch, where I'd step over Dad's semi-conscious form and back inside again. It was a great relief when, on the sixth day, Grandpa's four-wheeler broke down and Tyler and Luke took it apart to find the trouble. I sat on a large barrel of blue plastic, watching them, wondering when we could go home, when Dad would stop talking about the Illuminati, when Mother would stop leaving the room whenever Dad entered it. That night after dinner, Dad said it was time to go. "Get your stuff," he said. "We're hitting the road in a half hour." It was early evening, which Grandma said was a ridiculous time to begin a 12-hour drive. Mother said we should wait until morning, but Dad wanted to get home so he and the boys could scrap the next morning. "I can't afford to lose any more work days," he said. Mother's eyes darkened with worry, but she said nothing. I awoke when the car hit the first utility pole. I'd been asleep on the floor under my sister's feet, a blanket over my head. I tried to sit up, but the car was shaking, lunging. It felt like it was coming apart, and Audrey fell on top of me. I couldn't see what was happening, but I could feel and hear it. Another loud thud, a lurch, my mother screaming, "Tyler!" from the front seat, and a final violent jolt before everything stopped and silence set in. Several seconds passed in which nothing happened. Then I heard Audrey's voice. She was calling our names one by one. Then she said, "Everyone's here except Tara." I tried to shout, but my face was wedged under the seat, my cheek pressed to the floor. I struggled under Audrey's weight as she shouted my name. Finally, I arched my back and pushed her off, then stuck my head out of the blanket and said, "Here." I looked around. Tyler had twisted his upper body so that he was practically climbing into the back seat, his eyes bulging as he took in every cut, every bruise, every pair of wide eyes. I could see his face, but it didn't look like his face. Blood gushed from his mouth and down his shirt. I closed my eyes, trying to forget the twisted angles of his blood-stained teeth. When I opened them again, it was to check everyone else. Richard was holding his head, a hand over each ear like he was trying to block out a noise. Audrey's nose was strangely hooked, and blood was streaming from it down her arm. Luke was shaking, but I couldn't see any blood. I had a gash on my forearm from where the seat's frame had caught hold of me.
"Everyone all right?"
My father's voice. There was a general mumble.
"There are power lines on the car,"
Dad said.
"Nobody gets out till they've shut them off."
His door opened, and for a moment I thought he'd been electrocuted, but then I saw he'd pitched himself far enough so that his body had never touched the car and the ground at the same time. I remember peering at him through my shattered window as he circled the car, his red cap pushed back so the brim reached upward, licking the air. He looked strangely boyish. He circled the car, then stopped, crouching low, bringing his head level with the passenger seat.
"Are you okay?"
he said. Then he said it again. The third time he said it, his voice quivered. I leaned over the seat to see who he was talking to, and only then realized how serious the accident had been. The front half of the car had been compressed, the engine arched, curving back over itself like a fold in solid rock. There was a glare on the windshield from the morning sun. I saw crisscrossing patterns of fissures and cracks. The sight was familiar. I'd seen hundreds of shattered windshields in the junkyard, each one unique, with its particular spray of gossamer extruding from the point of impact, a chronicle of the collision. The cracks on our windshield told their own story. The epicenter was a small ring with fissures circling outward. The ring was directly in front of the passenger seat.
"You okay?"
Dad pleaded.
"Honey, can you hear me?"
Mother was in the passenger seat. Her body faced away from the window. I couldn't see her face, but there was something terrifying in the way she slumped against her seat.
"Can you hear me?"
Dad said. He repeated this several times. Eventually, in a movement so small it was almost imperceptible, I saw the tip of Mother's ponytail dip as she nodded. Dad stood, looking at the active power lines, looking at the earth, looking at Mother, looking helpless.
"Do you think, should I call an ambulance?"
I think I heard him say that. And if he did, which surely he must have, Mother must have whispered a reply. Or maybe she wasn't able to whisper anything, I don't know. I've always imagined that she asked to be taken home. I was told later that the farmer whose tractor we'd hit rushed from his house. He'd called the police, which we knew would bring trouble because the car wasn't insured and none of us had been wearing seatbelts. It took perhaps 20 minutes after the farmer informed Utah Power of the accident for them to switch off the deadly current pulsing through the lines. Then Dad lifted Mother from the station wagon, and I saw her face. Her eyes, hidden under dark circles the size of plums, and the swelling distorting her soft features, stretching some, compressing others. I don't know how we got home or when, but I remember that the mountain face glowed orange in the morning light. Once inside, I watched Tyler spit streams of crimson down the bathroom sink. His front teeth had smashed into the steering wheel and been displaced, so that they jutted backward toward the roof of his mouth. Mother was laid on the sofa. She mumbled that the light hurt her eyes. We closed the blinds. She wanted to be in the basement, where there were no windows, so Dad carried her downstairs, and I didn't see her for several hours, not until that evening, when I used a dull flashlight to bring her dinner. When I saw her, I didn't know her. Both eyes were a deep purple, so deep they looked black, and so swollen I couldn't tell whether they were open or closed. She called me Audrey, even after I corrected her twice. "Thank you, Audrey, but just dark and quiet, that's fine. Dark, quiet, thank you. Come check on me again, Audrey, in a little while." Mother didn't come out of the basement for a week. Every day the swelling worsened, the black bruises turned blacker. Every night I was sure her face was as marked and deformed as it was possible for a face to be, but every morning it was somehow darker, more tumid. After a week, when the sun went down, we turned off the lights and Mother came upstairs. She looked as if she had two objects strapped to her forehead, large as apples, black as olives. There was never any more talk of a hospital. The moment for such a decision had passed, and to return to it would be to return to all the fury and fear of the accident itself. Dad said doctors couldn't do anything for her anyhow. She was in God's hands. In the coming months, Mother called me by many names. When she called me Audrey, I didn't worry. But it was troubling when we had conversations in which she referred to me as Luke or Tony. And in the family, it had always been agreed, even by Mother herself, that she's never been quite the same since the accident. We kids called her Raccoon Eyes. We thought it was a great joke. Once the black rings had been around for a few weeks, long enough for us to get used to them and make them the subject of jokes. We had no idea it was a medical term. Raccoon eyes, a sign of serious brain injury. Tyler's guilt was all-consuming. He blamed himself for the accident, then kept on blaming himself for every decision that was made thereafter, every repercussion, every reverberation that clanged down through the years. He laid claim to that moment and all its consequences, as if time itself had commenced the instant our station wagon left the road, and there was no history, no context, no agency of any kind until he began it, at the age of 17, by falling asleep at the wheel. Even now, when Mother forgets any detail, however trivial, that look comes into his eyes, the one he had in the moments after the collision, when blood poured from his own mouth as he took in the scene, raking his eyes over what he imagined to be the work of his hands and his hands only. Me? I never blamed anyone for the accident, least of all Tyler. It was just one of those things. A decade later, my understanding would shift, part of my heavy swing into adulthood, and after that, the accident would always make me think of the Apache women and of all the decisions that go into making a life, the choices people make, together and on their own, that combine to produce any single event. Grains of sand, incalculable, pressing into sediment, then rock. Chapter 5. Honest Dirt. The mountain thawed, and the princess appeared on its face, her head brushing the sky. It was Sunday, a month after the accident, and everyone had gathered in the living room. Dad had begun to expound a scripture when Tyler cleared his throat and said he was leaving.
I'm going to college, he said, his face rigid. A vein in his neck bulged as he forced the words out, appearing and disappearing every few seconds, a great struggling snake.
Everyone looked at Dad. His expression was folded, impassive. The silence was worse than shouting. Tyler would be the third of my brothers to leave home. My oldest brother, Tony, drove rigs, hauling gravel or scrap, trying to scrape together enough money to marry the girl down the road. Sean, the next oldest, had quarreled with Dad a few months before and taken off. I hadn't seen him since, though Mother got a hurried call every few weeks telling her he was fine, that he was welding or driving rigs. If Tyler left too, Dad wouldn't have a crew, and without a crew, he couldn't build barns or hay sheds. He would have to fall back on scrapping.
"What's college?"
I said.
College is extra school for people too dumb to learn the first time around,
Dad said. Tyler stared at the floor, his face tense. Then his shoulders dropped, his face relaxed, and he looked up. It seemed to me that he'd stepped out of himself. His eyes were soft, pleasant. I couldn't see him in there at all. He listened to Dad, who settled into a lecture.
There's two kinds of them college professors, Dad said. Those who know they're lying, and those who think they're telling the truth.
Dad grinned.
Don't know which is worse, come to think of it. A bona fide agent of the Illuminati, who at least knows he's on the devil's payroll, or a high-minded professor who thinks his wisdom is greater than God's.
He was still grinning. The situation wasn't serious. He just needed to talk some sense into his son. Mother said Dad was wasting his time, that nobody could talk Tyler out of anything once his mind was made up. You may as well take a broom and start sweeping dirt off the mountain, she said. Then she stood, took a few moments to steady herself, and trudged downstairs. She had a migraine. She nearly always had a migraine. She was still spending her days in the basement, coming upstairs only after the sun had gone down, and even then she rarely stayed more than an hour before the combination of noise and exertion made her head throb. I watched her slow, careful progress down the steps, her back bent, both hands gripping the rail as if she were blind and had to feel her way. She waited for both feet to plant solidly on one step before reaching for the next. The swelling in her face was nearly gone, and she almost looked like herself again, except for the rings, which had gradually faded from black to dark purple and were now a mix of lilac and raisin. An hour later, Dad was no longer grinning. Tyler had not repeated his wish to go to college, but he had not promised to stay either. He was just sitting there, behind that vacant expression, writing it out.
A man can't make a living out of books and scraps of paper, Dad said. You're going to be the head of a family. How can you support a wife and children with books?
Tyler tilted his head, showed he was listening, and said nothing.
A son of mine, standing in line to get brainwashed by socialists and Illuminati spies. The school's run by the church,
Tyler interrupted.
How bad can it be?
Dad's mouth flew open and a gust of air rushed out.
You don't think the Illuminati have infiltrated the church?
His voice was booming, every word reverberated with a powerful energy.
You don't think the first place they'd go is that school, where they can raise up a whole generation of socialist Mormons? I raised you better than that.
I will always remember my father in this moment, the potency of him, and the desperation. He leans forward, jaw set, eyes narrow, searching his son's face for some sign of agreement, some crease of shared conviction. He doesn't find it. The story of how Tyler decided to leave the mountain is a strange one, full of gaps and twists. It begins with Tyler himself, with the bizarre fact of him. It happens sometimes in families. One child who doesn't fit, whose rhythm is off, whose meter is set to the wrong tune. In our family, that was Tyler. He was waltzing while the rest of us hopped a jig. He was deaf to the raucous music of our lives, and we were deaf to the serene polyphony of his. Tyler liked books. He liked quiet. He liked organizing and arranging and labeling. Once, Mother found a whole shelf of matchboxes in his closet, stacked by year. Tyler said they contained his pencil shavings from the past 5 years, which he had collected to make fire starters for our Head for the Hills bags. The rest of the house was pure confusion. Piles of unwashed laundry, oily and black from the junkyard, littered the bedroom floors. In the kitchen, murky jars of tincture lined every table and cabinet, and these were only cleared away to make space for even messier projects, perhaps to skin a deer carcass or strip cosmoline off a rifle. But in the heart of this chaos, Tyler had half a decade's pencil shavings, cataloged by year. My brothers were like a pack of wolves. They tested each other constantly, with scuffles breaking out every time.